Think of some of the mainstays of traditional magic shows, from snake charmers, levitation, rope tricks, live burial, jugglers, firewalking, swords pushed through boxes that appear to dissect a person, even beds of nails, and let's not forget the swallowing of things like swords and fire. Did you know that all of them have their origin in India? India has been imagined a land of magic, mysticism and sorcery, going back to the first written histories by the Greek writer Herodotus, who wrote about giant gold-digging ants. My guest has explored this very curious history and is here to tell us about it. John Zabriskie has worked in India as a diplomat, consultant, tour guide and correspondent for The Australian. His new book is called Empire of Enchantment, the story of Indian magic, and he joins me now. John, welcome to LNL.
Thank you very much. Honoured to be here.
It's a fascinating story. Just start us off with how far back this history of magic goes in India.
Well, look, it goes back to the Harappan civilization. So you're talking about 3,500 BC. And at that time, what you're looking at really is the use of talismans and amulets and charms. And so it's more a sort of sympathetic magic than entertainment magic, which is the primary focus of the book. But pretty much from about the 6th century BC, you start to get a lot of evidence of entertainment magic. So we're talking about jugglers, conjurers, mountebanks, and so on. We get references to them in the royal courts. There are references to the rope trick, for instance, in some of the Buddhist Jataka tales, which do date from the 6th century BC. So it goes back a long way.
How deeply linked is this tradition of magic to religion in India, specifically, say, Hinduism?
It is very strongly linked, yeah. There is a god of magic, Indra, who casts his net of magic across the world and spins this this concept of Maya or illusion is very much tied in with magic for obvious reasons, because magic is illusion in a sense. But that is pretty much the main distinction between magic in India and magic in the West, because in the West, the conjurer will not make any pretenses to the fact that what he or she is doing is anything other than magic based on scientific or rational grounds. In India, even your lowly street conjurer will always play with those boundaries between, you know, secular and religious magic, and use that to enhance his own powers, if you like, or his own hold over his audience.
And were the magicians or performers from a particular caste or a particular ethnic group in India?
Look, they do tend to be from the lower castes. When the British arrived in India and they started to categorise these groups, they found out that a lot of these jugglers, as they were known then, because that's what they were called, because a lot of their sleight of hand or their acrobatic acts or their physical dexterity, you know, they associated that with juggling as they'd known it in the West. They found out that a lot of them came from these lower castes. Many of them were nomadic. Some of them were related to groups of gypsies as well. They were eventually classified as criminal castes as well, and therefore persecuted as a result, and always remained marginalized. But they were both Hindus and Muslims.
The rest of the world has known about India's magic going right back to Herodotus. What did he say about those magical traditions in India?
Herodotus never went to India. So a lot of, and as you find in the writings, a lot of these early writings, a lot of it is hearsay. A lot of it is just stories that are brought back by maybe traders or, pilgrims or something like that. So, you know, it established in the minds of people India as this fantastical land where anything was possible.
Fanciful imaginations,
yes,
and exaggerations,
yes, exaggerations,
I imagine.
Yes.
But by someone who hadn't been there, but had an imagined idea
of
this land.
Yeah.
The medieval era seems to have been an important turning point in the spread of Indian magic. Was this when it started to spread, in particular to the Arab world?
Look, yes, there is evidence in the Abbasid Caliphate of Indian conjuring manuals that had been translated into Arabic, which is quite extraordinary. But it really goes back much further than that. I mean, there is evidence of Indian fortune tellers in the Roman Empire. There's Indian alchemists who were going to China to peddle longevity drugs and drugs that would increase somebody's sexual prowess. Magic is a very transnational thing. I mean, it easily crosses international boundaries, cultural boundaries, because it doesn't rely on language as such. It relies on performance.
What was it about the conditions that existed, do you think, in India? I mean, you've touched on the fact that there are religious and spiritual origins and connections, but what is it about the conditions of that country in particular that led to this fertile spreading of these it's mysticism and magic?
Oh, look, I guess it was tied up strongly with religion, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism as well, and plus this very, very strong tradition of magic as entertainment, as a cultural art form, really, which you find evidence of that goes back a very long way.
So, what kind of impact then did British imperial control over India have on the development of magic and on its global notoriety?
Well, look, I guess the main effect was Indian magicians actually made it to England. So what happened in about 1813, the captain of one of these Englishmen, one of these ships that sailed, did the route between England and India, he spotted a group of jugglers, as they were known, in Madras, offered them a passage to England and the promise of great pecuniary rewards if they accompanied him. It was against their caste to cross the Black Sea, as it was termed then, because they would lose their caste purity if they did that, but they decided to go anyway. And this first group of jugglers, there was three of them, they performed at Pall Mall, and they were a sensation and really changed the face of Western magic as a result, because the sorts of things that they could do, sword swallowing, juggling balls, throwing, stones over their shoulders, balancing acts, as well as, extraordinary sleight of hand tricks, just captured the public's imagination. So that was really one of the main effects of that colonial.
And this was a new form of entertainment in England that the audiences had not been exposed to
they
before?
They had never been exposed to it. So, for a long time, people had read about these wonder workers of India. You would get references to them in travelers' tales, in memoirs, in books like Marco Polo's Travels, for instance, and so on. But this was the first time they'd had any direct contact with them.
So, did English magic exist to any extent around that time?
Oh, yes, certainly.
What did it look like in comparison?
Look, English magic was pretty much a fairground. It was really confined to the fairground. When they came, it was moving from the fairground to the stage. But look, a lot of the tricks were similar. Take something like the cups and balls, where you have three cups and balls, which the magician moves around, and balls disappear, reappear. You go from having two balls to three balls to four balls and that sort of thing. That trick probably goes back to Roman times, but it was definitely a staple of fairground conjuring in the 15th, 16th century, and Indian magicians used it as well. So, there a lot of these tricks were similar, but it was the way in which the Indians performed it. It was the incredible feats of dexterity that they exhibited, which really caught the public's imagination.
Well, by the 19th century, Indian magic had spawned armies of imitators, Westerners basically pretending to be Indian, and I suppose the most famous among them was Harry Houdini.
Look, Houdini started off dressed as a Hindu fakir, which is an oxymoronic term in the first place, at the Columbian Exhibition in Chicago in 1893. But then after that, he didn't actually appropriate these Indian costumes. Some of the tricks that he performed, one of which was swallowing a bunch of needles and some thread and then extricating them from his mouth all threaded together, was an Indian trick that he'd picked up, probably from a conjurer who was at this exhibition that he performed at. But there were lots more. In fact, there was a writer in about 1935 who complained of the fakir invasion, because there was, you had the fakir of Shiva, the fakir of Jaipur, the fakir of Ulu, the fakir of Ava, all completely made up, and each of them claiming to be the greatest of their class.
So passing themselves off as Indian magicians.
And some of them doing it very convincingly. Probably the best known case of it is actually someone who started off as an Indian, started off pretending he was Indian, then pretended he was Egyptian, eventually pretended he was Chinese, and that was William Robinson, who performed as Chung Ling Fu, called himself the original Chinese conjurer, when there was a real Chinese conjurer called Ching Ling Su performing in America at the same time. People thought that Robinson was the real Chinaman as opposed to the actual Chinaman.
This is L&L on RN and on the ABC Listen app and online. My guest is John Zabriskie, and he's written a book called Empire of Enchantment, The Story of Indian Magic, which he's talking to me about. John, you write about a trio of tricks that came to epitomise Indian magic: the basket trick, the mango tree trick, and the rope trick. Mm-hmm. Let's talk through what made each of them so important. Let's start with the Hindu basket trick.
That was the first magic trick I saw when I first went to India in the late 70s. And basically what you see is a magician with a round basket into which his assistant, usually a young boy or a young girl, climbs. Then he takes this great big sword or knife and starts plunging it into the basket. There's no way that, at least the audience thinks, there's no way that the person trapped inside can escape the thrusts of this blade. And every time he withdraws the blade, it's covered in blood and there's screaming and all of that sort of stuff. There are different versions of it, of course, but the version I saw ended with the boy being lifted out of the basket with the knife through his neck. And, I was maybe a meter or two away, and as far as I could tell, there was no trickery involved.
Wow.
And that was one of the first tricks that Western magicians took up in about the 1850s, 1860s.
And what's it like seeing a trick like that performed in India?
Extraordinary, extraordinary. Because, look, the difference is that in India, it is performed out in the open. There are no trapdoors, no mirrors, there's no stage. This was, outside a railway station. The magician is completely encircled by a crowd. So unlike the Western magician who performs on a stage, has the advantage of lighting and mirrors and the fact that there's a distance between him and the audience. That doesn't happen in India. And that's what makes Indian conjuring so extraordinary.
So I understand that some of these tricks have been broadcast on television, and in 1956, the BBC TV showed this trick and the switchboard melted down. Tell us about that.
That's the story of P.C. Sorkar. So he called himself the world's greatest magician, and he started calling himself that even before he'd even left India, much to the chagrin of Western, his fellow Western conjurers. He was a bit of an upstart. He was a great publicist. He was struggling to make it as a magician in the West. In 1956, he appears on the Panorama program. Television is in its infancy, but this is going live to air. He has his assistant on a table and this giant buzzsaw that slices her in two. Then he tries to revive her, has no luck. At that point, Richard Dimbleby, the presenter, steps in and says, "Sorry, the program's going overtime. We have to, cut the transmission now." And that is when the switchboard went into meltdown, because obviously people thought that what they'd seen on stage was a person being murdered live on stage.
Wow.
And that was the turning point in his career. He was the rest of his season in London was a sellout, and he never looked back.
Mm. Okay, the mango tree trick. Yes. What was that?
The mango tree trick is basically what happens is the conjurer takes a mango seed, plants it in the bare earth or in a pot, throws a blanket over it, mutters a few incantations, throws the blanket off. There was nothing there to start with. What you see is a small sprout. Does it several times, and every time he throws a blanket off, the tree gets bigger until eventually it is the size of a small bush and there are ripe mangoes growing on it. Yeah.
And this is a significant trick because it becomes the go-to trick for many, many magicians.
Yeah. Yeah, look, there were versions of it. There was a version performed in 1847 by a Frenchman, Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin, who was called the father of modern magic. He did it using a mechanical tree, which produced oranges. But it was basically the idea came from the mango tree trick. He didn't acknowledge its provenance, but it was still obviously quite a sensation when it was done on stage. But yeah, it was taken up by quite widely by Western magicians.
But you argue the most important trick of all was the rope trick, which you say would become the benchmark against which all feats of Indian magic would be measured at. Tell us about the rope trick. What was it and what made it so important?
Well, look, it's think of Jack and the Beanstalk, the legend of Jack and the Beanstalk, of, you know, a planting a seed, a, you know, this tree or whatever, you know, that reaches up into the heavens, climbing, you know, the boy or a man climbs up and disappears. I mean, that's a common trope that you find in a lot of cultures. So in India, that was basically the premise. The magician would get a rope, throw it in the air where it would stay upright, the end of it sort of disappearing into the clouds or whatever. A boy would climb up, disappear, and then what would happen, the boy's limbs would come raining down, you know, first the head and then an arm and a leg and then the torso and all that. These would be gathered up by the magician. A blanket would be thrown over them. Again, some magic words would be said. The blanket would be taken off and the boy would reappear whole, you know, unharmed. The rope would fall down. So it was, again, it's a trick that you can find references to it, as I said, earlier on, going back to the 6th century, but it was a piece of fake news in 1890 in the Chicago Tribune, which actually brought it, you know, to world attention, if you like. There was the Chicago Tribune published a story which purported that a couple of people had gone to India to witness the trick. What they found when they one was one had a camera and the other one was sketching what was happening. The trick was performed, but when the film was developed, there was nothing there. So the premise was that the magician had hypnotized the crowd. The story was actually just a hoax in order to sell more newspapers. And one of the principal characters who was named in the story was a guy called Fred S. Elmore. So Fred Selmore, but nobody got the joke. And when they retracted the story about 4 months later, it was too late because it had gone viral and had, you know, people just and started this debate as to whether the trick was real or not. And so you had people coming forward who claimed to have seen the trick, and then you had the Western magic fraternity saying, this is a hoax, it can't happen.
That the trick had never been performed.
Had never been performed.
No. Because it does strike me as a trick that would be rather difficult to pull off,
yes.
And so is there anything that you give away about this about this trick, about whether you thought it was performed or wasn't performed in your book, or are you not at liberty to tell us about this?
Look, well, read the book. No. Look, I try not to give away too many of the secrets that behind some of these tricks. The trick was duplicated on the Western stage, and it was, and they could get away with doing it using, you know, you would throw a rope up that would catch on a wire that was hidden from the audience's view. You know, a boy would climb up and disappear. It probably might not include the limbs raining down and being reassembled, but it was enough to sort of give audiences at least a taste of, of this trick and just how extraordinary it was.
Did you feel bound by that convention amongst modern day musicians that you must not, even though you've researched the history and provenance of these tricks, you must not allude to how they are created?
Well, look, up to a point, what also happened was, around the late 19th, early 20th century was because Indian magic was seen as a bit of a threat by the Western conjuring fraternity. And one way of neutralizing, you know, the attraction of Indian magic, you know, or trying to stop people from thinking that India was a place where real magic happens, where real miracles that, you know, defy the laws of nature happen, was to expose how these tricks were done. Mm. So, you know, there you could pick up a newspaper, you could pick up a magazine, you could pick up a conjuring journal, and the method behind the execution of these tricks would be explained. So, and yes, you know, I do go into that. But having said that, I've also been to India and I've seen a lot of magic, which I cannot explain.
Just quickly and finally, how is magic faring in modern day India?
Look, traditional street magic is faring not very well. You know, it's getting very tough for traditional street magicians to perform in cities, for instance. In Delhi, there's something called the Beggary Act, the Bombay Beggary Act, but it applies to Delhi, which bans begging, which seems extraordinary because anyone who's been to India would be accosted by beggars on street corners and so on, whenever they're in a car or a taxi. But it applies to street performers and it applies to magicians. So if you want to do a magic show on a street in India, you've got to bribe the police. If you don't bribe the police, they'll beat you up or they'll drag you and lock you up for a night. Mm. It's tough. It's getting tough. And, you know, and also, you know, the economic imperatives aren't there anymore. Kids don't want to follow their, you know, fathers and
same old story,
stay
isn't
in
it?
The magic trade. You know, they want to learn English. They want to, you know, learn about how computers work and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it is a dying art, unfortunately.
Great story though. Thanks for telling us, John.
Pleasure.
John Zabriskie's book is called Empire of Enchantment: The Story of Indian Magic, and it's published by Scribe.